Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Congressman John Katko. Congressman Katko represents New York's 24th Congressional District. He's currently serving in his third term and was recently reelected to his fourth. Congressman Katko serves on the Homeland Security Committee and the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure. He was recently named to be the lead Republican on the Homeland Security Committee, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about today. Congressman Katko, first of all, congratulations on your reelection, and I want to thank you for making the time for this conversation.
Well, thanks a lot. I always love speaking with you, and I'm happy to talk to you today about these topics. It's a lot of excitement going forward.
Great, thanks. Well, let me just start with a couple questions about the election itself, and then we'll move on from there. But Republicans seem to overperform in this election all around the country relative to the expectations that were going in and the polls that we saw prior to the election. And that was true from President Trump all the way down the ballot to more local races. And we'll talk about your race in a minute, but I wanted to just see what you made of this phenomenon more generally, this boost that the Republicans seem to have gotten on Election Day.
Well, I mean, there's two factors I think that come into play. The first factor is, I think from an issue standpoint, I think a lot more Americans than people realize we're tuned in and agree with the Republican agenda, that is lowering taxes and not having government health care and those types of issues. So I think that really helped drive the narrative more so than usual. And I think the phenomenon naturally really was you had a president whose ideas, his policies were relatively popular, but whose personality was not. And so I think that is that's what I saw. But I also saw that time and again, it's awful strange to me how many pollsters got it wrong in favor of the Democrats, in that all along they were saying this is a race and when it really wasn't. And how much did that affect things? We will never really know. And did it dampen enthusiasm in some tight states like Wisconsin or Georgia? I don't know. But The bottom line is, it was a strange phenomenon where an awful lot of pollsters, in fact, all of them, look, our race in particular is another good example. They looked at our race and they said it was a dead heat. It's really close. And our internal polls showed otherwise the entire time. And, you wonder why all those polls were doing that. And there was some sort of inherent bias, or was it just bad polling again? How could they miss it again? How could they did it in 2016? How could they be so wrong twice? So I thought that was interesting. But in the end, Biden did win nationally. And I think that, moving on, it's going to be interesting just to see if the pollsters really do have any self-evaluation going on. I'll do what they do after 2016 and just move on.
So your race seemed like, in some ways, even more of an outlier than some of the other ones because, you mentioned internal polling. I want to hear about that in a minute. But I believe the final tally has had you with like a 10-point margin. Is that about right?
Yeah, I was very honored to get another term. And I'm incredibly humbled. But I'm also incredibly proud of my constituents because they know how to cut through the nonsense and look at the issues for what they are. And we won by 10 percentage points. That's about 35,000 votes. And it was not nearly as close as everyone on a lot of the pundits said it was going to be. And I think
were you surprised by that? Were you surprised on election night?
By the margin itself, maybe a little bit, but we were relatively confident that we were going to win this. And our polling the entire time had us anywhere from 4 to 8 points up. Okay. Including the last week, we had us up 7. Then you had the top of the ticket. I received 28,000 more votes than the president, which shows that there's a lot of ticket splitting that went on in my district. He lost by 9 and I won by 10. And there's no doubt that individuals were evaluating me based on myself, not based on the president. And I'm very proud of them for that.
Now, about your election, you were criticized in the Post Standard. They did endorse you, but as part of that endorsement, they were critical, and some other observers were critical of some aspects of your campaign this time around. And it did seem to me that some of your ads did try to demonize your opponent. And one of them had some imagery that at least some people found offensive. I just wanted to ask you, given the outcome that you won by 10, do you have now, looking back, any misgivings about some of the messaging that
I think that's laughable that they were concerned about some of the messages and some of the nastiness in the campaign with some of the things they did with me and some of the things they misrepresented about me. I don't cry about it because that's politics and that's what you have to do. And your messaging and counter messaging has to answer that. When you're talking about the imagery, every image that we use in the commercials were posted either by my opponent herself or by people that support her. And she was proud of the imagery at the time. And then when we use it against her to show that she was more radical and to the left, she thought it was, she used words that just were ridiculous to me. This was her, and she was proud of those images at one time. And then now she's trying to use it against, saying that somehow it was wrong and we did. Those images showed who she really is, that she was too far left for this district. The paper recognized that when they endorsed me, and my constituents recognized that when they overwhelmingly reelected me.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Congressman John Katko. So you and I have talked a lot in the past in our interviews about President Trump. It seems like it's been forever that we've been talking about President Trump.
Indeed.
One thing I think is clear, and that is looking back, and that is that the president put you in a very difficult political situation. And so my first question is very simple. Will you be glad to see him out of office, all things considered?
No, look, I'm concerned about him losing because of the policies and the things we're able to accomplish for the American people, the lowest unemployment in the history of our country for African Americans and other minorities and women, and the economy going at a great pace. We finally got some fairness with respect to our trade deals, and we're securing the border. I'm very concerned about those things all getting rolled back. Another one is the Iran nuclear deal. So he did a lot of good things. His personality was his downfall, in my opinion. And it's not, I'm not going to miss having a microphone shoved in my mouth every day and someone asking me what I think about what someone else said instead of what I think. And so that aspect I won't miss at all, but I will miss the policies big time, and because they were very important.
And I listened, you had a telephone town hall the other day. Mm-hmm. We're speaking on a Friday morning. I think you had it on a Wednesday night, Tuesday night, something like that.
Yes, yep.
And I listened to it, and one of the themes of many of the questions that you got had to do with the conduct of the president now, mm-hmm. regarding the election. And you had several people on the call that were very, very concerned about the harm that they thought the president was doing to this country and our electoral system going forward and basically our democracy by the way that he is refusing to accept the fact that President Biden is the president-elect and he's continuing on with these different kinds of lawsuits. There's yet another wrinkle in that story in the headlines today. So I'm just wondering, you did use the word president-elect Biden in that town hall, but is it time now for Republicans like yourself to really kind of come out more strongly with wording about having the president stop what he's doing?
Yeah, I don't know what else people want out of me, but out of some of my colleagues, they probably should ask that they do what I've already done and say, look, President Biden, president-elect Biden won the election. That's clear. If you believe there's evidence of fraud, you can test it in the court. That's absolutely your right. He has tested it in the court and it hasn't worked for him. So, and they have also, on December 8th, they certified the election. And there's this Hail Mary thing going on with the Supreme Court right now, which I don't think is going to amount to anything. And I may be wrong, but the window for claiming that there is material fraud that would change the outcome of the election, that time is coming to a close. And it's time for us to move on. And I said before, and I'll say again, I want this president, President-elect Biden, to be the most successful president ever, just like I wanted Trump and just like I wanted Obama, because for the good of this country, we've got to rally around and move forward. And the concerns that my constituents noted about the harm to the country, I can understand what they're saying. I do believe it's going to be short-lived, and I do believe we're going to get past this, and we're going to move on, and we're going to learn from it. And I think this is just a moment in time, and we have a tremendous ability to get past things.
And just one other question on that, because you were a federal prosecutor for many years. So let's imagine you're prosecuting this case, so to speak. I mean, I know the evidence isn't in front of you, but based on what you've seen and what you've heard, would you be pushing this case forward at this point?
No. I mean, evidence, facts are facts, right? I can't tell you how many times I did a case where I believed person X did the gang murder. And it turns out that person Y did. And I found out that the real person did it and why they did it, because I followed the facts, not what I wanted them to be, but what they are. And if you follow the facts here, we don't have enough to state the case. So if you don't have enough to state the case, it's time to move on. That's how I feel.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher. We'll continue the conversation after a short break. Welcome back to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Congressman John Katko. He represents New York's 24th Congressional District and was recently reelected to his fourth term. So also, in addition to being elected to your fourth term, you were recently named to be the ranking member, which means the highest Republican on the Homeland Security Committee. So I think just first of all, for our listeners, give us an idea of what kinds of things fall under the purview of that committee.
Well, it's a tremendous amount of responsibility, and I'm pretty honored for it. And getting it after only 6 years is a pretty short time frame to get in, so I'm pretty proud. But Homeland Security and its component agencies have 240,000 employees and a $50 billion budget. They do everything from dealing from border security to election security to terrorism, both nationally and internationally, election security, all kinds of things. And so anything that's related to keeping the country safe or keeping it secure, and we're on the front lines of that. My job is, and my job on my committee members is to provide oversight of Homeland Security and their subcommittees. For example, when I was head of the subcommittee for TSA for 4 years, we had 18 hearings bringing TSA to get them out of the Stone Ages and get their act together. And I dare say that's a lot better agency today than it was 6 years ago. And we've got the job to do on for every component agency, as well as the Department of Homeland Security as a whole. So it's an awful lot of responsibility.
You know, I know that there's no longer the earmark system that there used to be in Congress. But is it possible that Homeland Security and your position on that might put you in a position to influence some funding coming back to the district?
Oh God, yes. Think about it. The flooding in Lake Ontario, right? If that happens, it's a disaster. Does FEMA act in an appropriate manner, and do they get the appropriate funding up here? They haven't in the past, and I can have an influence on having them do their job and make sure they do. All the cybersecurity attacks on the schools last year, I brought people up from the various agencies to try and shed light on that. And we can do more of that and try and do more to keep our cyber networks secure up here. Election security, I did an awful lot with election security last year, pointing out a lot of the problems with trying to get these local boards of elections. There's 62 disparate boards in New York State alone, one for each county, and get them to understand when we're sending them election security cyber information, can they digest it? They can't. We got to do better with that. Those are just some examples. There's so many more, but I mean, they're chapter and verse. Homeland Security touches pretty much everything of everyone's lives as far as security goes.
And tell us a little bit about the role of a ranking member. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I have to represent the Republican Party's interests. And there's only a handful of committees in Congress, and that being head of one of them is a pretty high honor. But I have to represent their interests, and I have to look out for the interests of all Americans to keep this country safe. But where we differ from the Democrats, I've got to point out those differences. And I don't intend to do it by going on Fox News and ranting and raving, but I intend to do it by just pointing out the differences. And an example would be is, what is the impact from a safety standpoint from defunding the police? And we look at New York City, crime is off the hook. They cut the police department by $1 billion out of a $6 billion budget. And it's ground zero for terrorist targets. So I point out things like that, just lay out the facts. I'm a prosecutor. And when I have differences with the Democrats, I'm just gonna lay out the facts and let people decide for themselves.
If the House should, House representatives should shift back to Republican control in either 2022 or 2024, which is a little more possible, I think, than one would have thought prior to these elections, because they did lose a bit of their majority. And you were still the ranking member. Does that mean that you would become that committee's chair, or is there another piece in the middle of that?
No, that means I'd become the chair. And if you look at it, the House right now, it's going to be anywhere from a 5-seat to a 7-seat majority. We won 12 to 13 seats in the House, it looks like. And we were expected to lose 15 to 20. Again, the pundits were way off, right? And so now it's one of the smallest majorities in modern times. And you have this historical trend that has been pretty much continued unabated, where the first election after a president gets in the White House, usually that president loses lots of seats in his party. Of course, Trump after 2 years lost 40, but Obama after 2 years lost 80 seats. So they have to lose just 5 or 6 more seats and we're in a majority. So it's a high, very high probability that's going to happen.
Well, I'm wondering, so if that happens and you become chair of what is a major committee in Congress, is that going to change your sense of how long you might stay there? Because you have all along said, you know, I believe it's 12 years. You say, I'm gone in 12 years and that's it. But if you become the chair of Homeland Security, doesn't that change things a little bit?
No, the math is perfect because it's a 6-year term. On the Republican side, we have term limits. You can't serve more than 6 years. So the magic number for me, I'd be 12 years and I'd be done with Homeland Security. So it's perfect time to pull the pin, you know? So it just worked out perfectly. It really did. I'm going to stick to that, I promise you.
What's that say again?
I'm going to stick to that, I promise you.
Okay. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is New York Congressman John Katko. He represents the 24th District. So you are also part of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus in the House. And that caucus had several weeks ago put forward a compromise second stimulus bill, which it had some traction at first. Then it seemed to lose the traction. Then it got it back. Now it seems to have lost it. Where is a future stimulus right now?
First of all, welcome to Congress, right? That's what it's like, right? But here's where I think they've had major agreements on pretty much all of the components of our proposal, except two, and I'll get to those in a minute. But I want to take a step back and just so people understand, the Problem Solvers Caucus is an equal group of 20 Democrats and Republicans, 25 on each side. We meet all the time and we try to find bipartisan solutions. This has really put us on the roadmap, on the map for leadership in the Congress, because this proposal is being seen as a blueprint from us to move forward for the first time. And we're putting tremendous pressure on both sides because we have bipartisan support. So they've agreed on a lot of the big things like the unemployment insurance and paycheck protection program, personal protective equipment, all those things, the money to schools, all that. There's two sticking points. One is the aid to state and local governments, which Republicans in the Senate view as a bailout to the Democratic states that have the fiscal mismanagement. And on the other side, you have liability limitations, which the Democrats don't want. So, and Republicans deride that as saying they're part of the plaintiffs' lobby, that's why. And the Democrats say we're just trying to protect people's rights. Who knows where they're right on either one of those two things, but those two things are the sticking point. There's been some proposals the last few days to take those two things out of it and just pass what we can all agree on now and keep working on the rest, right? We may have to do that. The wild card is what happens if the Democrats win both seats in Georgia. Then the Democrats have complete control of legislative process. They would, possibly, if they change some of the rules in the Senate. If we win one of those two races, we're going to have divided government. So there's this kind of, everybody's trying to figure out what the strategic value is. And I and all the others in the Problem Solvers Caucus say, cut the crap. People are really suffering. This pandemic is raging and rearing its ugly head again, terribly so. And we cannot wait till January. And a lot of people are saying, and I agree, better to spend $900 billion now than $2 trillion in March. $2 trillion in March is too late. And the economic calamity will be irreversible, in my opinion. So I'm hopeful that cooler heads will prevail. There's a little bit of a poker game going on right now to see who blinks first. But I think some components of that Problem Solvers Caucus proposal are going to get across the finish line next week.
Just two quick questions on that. You mentioned the Senate races in Georgia. Even if the Democrats win those, I believe that makes it 50-50. So they'd have the tie-breaking vote with Vice President Harris. But you've got folks like Senator Manchin in that group. So I'm wondering whether there'd be an ability to ram something through, even if they were to make the move to eliminate the
filibuster,
which most political scientists think will hurt the Democrats long-term, because if you look at the next two election cycles, the Republicans are well set up demographically in the Senate elections. I mean, there's a lot in the weeds, but...
No, you're right, though. Not in the weeds, because that's a practical reality. The Democrats got to make a decision if they get the House. If they get rid of the filibuster rule and they go to a simple majority vote, they will have 50 senators plus Kamala Harris as a tiebreaker as vice president of the Senate, president of the Senate. So there's been a lot of talk that they want to do that. And will they do it just to get their signature programs through? Would it be worth it for them to ram through Medicare for all? Who knows? But if they do it, I agree with you. The long-term ramifications could be quite bad. But they are, all those thoughts are going through the heads of these folks, and they're trying to figure out, okay, what do we agree to now versus what we agree to later? I think it's good. One thing that's interesting about all this is Nancy Pelosi has not been seen as a good negotiator, because the Problem Solvers Caucus came out in August with a $1.5 trillion proposal for the COVID relief, and she said no. The White House then upped it to $1.8 trillion, and she said no. And now we come out with $900 billion, and she says yes. That's not good negotiating. She should have taken what we gave her earlier, but I don't know what's going to happen. But I dearly hope that cooler heads prevail, because we all know America's suffering. We got to get something done.
And on that last point, do you think there's any hope for a second round of direct stimulus checks being sent to citizens like there was the first time?
Well, what we had was in our Problem Solvers proposal is the unemployment insurance plus $300 above it. I've seen one proposal where they give the unemployment insurance and extend it, but take that $300 out of there and use that as $600 payments to Americans of a certain income level. So there is some talk of it. Whether that is going to make it into final version or not, I don't know. I think it would be great if we could do it, but let's see. I think the Paycheck Protection Program is so critical. So many jobs are hanging in the balance. If you go down Armory Square and walk around any restaurant there, all of them are sucking air. None of them are going to make it, I don't think, if they don't get some help soon.
We got about 3 minutes left, and I want to give you some time to put forward what your priorities are going to be in your next term. But there's a very quick question I want to squeeze in before we get to that. So sure. Make sure that happens. I'll ask the quick one now and then the other one.
Okay.
I'm looking at you. I'm seeing you've still got your beard. I'm assuming that means you have not been successful in your hunting endeavors yet.
Actually, I was successful on opening day and dropped a deer in my first shot. And but it's hunting season's not over yet. And my wife hates it, so it will be coming off soon. But I'm going out hunting again this weekend, so I'm going to leave it on.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
That's there. So in about a couple minutes or so, I just want to give you some time to set forward what your priorities will be for your next term. I mean, I assume, first of all, it's going to be COVID, COVID, and COVID. But then after that, do you have any ideas?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I want to be able to support manufacturers locally and employers locally. Infrastructure is going to be really important for us. And I think that's something we can get done. The opioid crisis has been this quiet killer, though, this year. It's a doubled number of fatalities this year over last. And that's something I'm very concerned about. The cyber attacks in our school system, I'm very concerned about. We got to keep going with that. And then the committee work and, you know, staying on the International Joint Commission and making sure that they, you know, we keep the water levels at reasonable levels. We do more oversight on that. There's just so many things locally, but the economic revitalization is going to be at the top of that. And obviously getting the COVID under control and people healthy and the economy back up and running is going to be very, very important.
And in our last minute, we only got about a minute, but I think with COVID, we've not seen much discussion about this, but there is this issue for the city of Syracuse still of the replacement of I-81. Mm-hmm. You've made a lot of statements about that, but where are we with that, and what would you like to see going forward?
Well, here's my concern with I-81 is we provide the matching dollars, or we provide 80% of the funding for the project, and the locals governments provide the rest. And I have backed proposals to give a one-year moratorium on the New York State 20% or so matching fund for the project. So we get the project up and running, get the 80%, but actually pay 100% the first year. Then after that, New York State, assuming their tax revenue gets back to normal, they can pay off the rest. But I've supported that. We need to get that project moving forward. Every day we waste is another day where that viaduct could have a major structural problem, where they just rebuild the viaduct and the issue is over. So I'm very hopeful that we can get this thing going, get it going soon.
Thank you. That was Congressman John Katko. He represents New York's 24th Congressional District. Congressman Katko, first of all, I want to thank you, as always, for talking with me. And as I wished you, I think last August when we spoke, good health to you and your family. And I also want to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Yeah, you too, my friend. I always enjoy speaking with you. I'm always amazed at how quickly the time goes. It's awesome.
It does fly. Thank you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.